This is Vershawn Young, host of New Books in African American Studies, and today I'll be speaking with Elaine Richardson about her provocative new memoir, PhD to PhD, How Education Saved My Life, published by New City Community Press and Parlor Press this year, 2013. Please listen in to this lively interview. Hi, Elaine.
Hello.
Elaine Richardson is a professor in the Department of Education at The Ohio State University. She is the author of several books covering such topics as African-American literacies, rhetoric, feminisms, and hip-hop. Today, we're speaking to her about her provocative new memoir, PhD to PhD, How Education Saved My Life. It is published by New City Community Press and Parlor Press this year in 2013. We are so happy to have Elaine Richardson on the show today. Elaine, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I am a professor of literacy studies at The Ohio State University. I am a native of Ohio. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And I have three daughters. I do a lot of work in the community with youth, young people. One of my books is called Hip Hop Literacy. So I do a lot of work with young ladies and youth around popular culture and identity and knowledge, how to basically read how other people are reading you and how your identity is being influenced by popular culture and how to think critically about those things. So those are things that I work on with young people. I'm also a recording artist, a songwriter, a performer. I love music. That's something that I've always loved. Didn't know exactly how to do it professionally as a young person. But I'm just, at this point, going for my gusto.
Very nice.
In all areas of my life.
And you mentioned that you are a performer, and I should say right at the start that the book we're going to be talking about, PhD to PhD, How Education Saved My Life, is also a solo one-woman show that you do. Is that right?
It is. It's based on excerpts from the book. My friend and colleague, Dr. Mary Weems, who is a phenomenal poet and writer, so really a creative writer, she helped, well, she actually, you know, wrote the play based on excerpts from the book. So I took, you know, most of what she wrote and put a performance to it. And it really has been an experience performing the book, performing excerpts from the book. You know, I had been writing this book for years, and it was a very therapeutic process writing the book because there were some things that I didn't even know were still hurting me
mm-hmm.
or that, you know, that I would feel emotional about
mm-hmm.
until I started writing about some of those things that had been packed down in my spirit. Way down so far that I, you know, just, you know, you, at some point you just keep living and you don't even, you know, it's just back there, something that happened. Mm-hmm. But once you start writing about those things, it comes back to you. And so performing excerpts from the book, you know, is still very gripping for me.
Yeah.
Very gripping for me. It's not like you can just perform it and you just act in it, you know, you're just going through the motions. Cool. It's like I take myself there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something. It's really something. So it's a very different process. And so I've been using even that in my teaching now with what I do in my work with middle school girls is that all the things that we learn and talk about have to come from your real life. You can connect. You connect it to, you know, things that you don't know about or that you want to know about, but you start from you. and they have to perform in some way their knowledge at the end of the year. And it's hard.
Right.
It's really hard.
Yes. Very nice. Yeah, I totally believe in performance as well as a mode of education and as a mode of interpreting and presenting life to others. You used the word gripping a moment ago, and I want to say that your book is enormously gripping, and I don't want to tiptoe around it or dilly-dally and getting right into the heart of discussing this book. While your book is a story of triumph, which comes through very much at the end, it's three quarters of it is a story of struggle, of your struggle living in the streets of Cleveland. We do see at the end of the book that you go on to Cleveland State and also to Michigan State universities that set you on the path to enormous success as a scholar. But tell us what this book is about and what brought you to write it?
Well, the book is about my journey from struggles with identity, struggles with sexuality, struggles with self-love, self-esteem, trying to, you know, figure out who I was. I was raped at, and even before the rape, I'm almost getting into a pattern of starting there, but even before then, I remember just being, I felt different. I felt like I didn't fit in with other people at a very young age. I remember one incident that made me feel that way was my parents had a fight when I was very young, and it was the only fight they ever had, a physical knockdown, you know, duke it out bug. And but that fight, it really crushed me. I don't even know how old I was. Maybe I was 5, 6, somewhere around in there. I think I was 5. Just seeing that fight and going to school the next day, I couldn't even concentrate. They made me come back home because I was just so, you know, devastated by that fight. So I think that was one thing. And then my parents never slept together again. My mom and I shared a room together after that. So it was just, you know, I always felt like something was wrong with my family. Now, my mom and dad, they weren't alcoholics. They worked every day. They didn't do, you know, that I guess you could call it normal dysfunction, if there is such a thing. Mm-hmm. We were dysfunctional, but
but functioning.
But, you know, but not, you know, I think everybody's family is dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's some ideal family somewhere. So I know that my family was dysfunctional, but at that time I felt like we must be the only dysfunctional people around. And, you know, there's something wrong with my family and there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. And this anecdote is also in the book. In the opening chapters, you tell us about this. Go on.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was that. And I think it was also that, My parents were different from other people's parents in the neighborhood. My mother was a Jamaican immigrant. She had a very heavy accent. People were not used to Jamaicans in Cleveland at that time. You know, so people used to ask me, you know, why your mama talk funny? Why do y'all food smell funny? You know, stuff like that. And so trying to fit in with kids in the neighborhood. Also, my parents were older than everybody else's parents. And so people, you know, I remember riding the bus with my mother and people would ask her, oh, is that your granddaughter? You know, and so, you know, just things like that. And also not being pretty, not fitting that stereotype of what people said was pretty. from images and magazines, from things that came on television, from hearing my brother, you know, watching television with my brother and looking through magazines with my brother and his friends. You know, I would listen to who they pointed out as the pretty girls or who he said was pretty. And I never looked like any of the people that were identified as pretty. And I know that, you know, that my brother didn't think I was ugly, but I got from that I was ugly. And you know, just those kind of incidents and you know, being raped at 13, mm-hmm. I think those were the foundation of the spiritual sickness and also the looking for validation outside of myself. Even though, you know, I know my parents love me. I know my brother loves me, but I just didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel good about myself.
And I'm hoping that hoping that we can also unpack some of these things that you're saying right now. But I just want to interject and ask, so you've laid out some of the foundational issues that impacted you and that you begin the book with, but why write about it?
I think it's important because people have made education seem like it's this narrow thing that is all about, you know, addition, subtraction, division, calculus, algebra, standardized writing, standardized reading, you know, the professions and all of these things and being able to pass tests. And I think that learning is so deep and that you're learning every single day from everything that you consume. And people are reading you and people have ideas about what you mean, what your body means. And you have ideas about what your body means as you walk through the world. And all of that has something to do with your identity and, you know, the experience, the way that you experience the world, and all of that has something to do with learning. Mm-hmm. So I've gone from, you know, when I finally did figure out what I wanted to major in as a undergraduate and master's and then PhD student, when I got into applied linguistics and language and literacy studies, I understood that there was this, you know, like that you had to understand this culture, history, and background of anybody that you're teaching. Like that is important to literacy education. And but I didn't have it, you know, like I had more of a narrow idea about it when I first started. You know, like you're supposed to respect people's language and culture and use that as a means of helping them to become masters of the word so that they could be persuasive and be, you know, conscious of, you know, using whatever language forms you want to use to be able to be successful in whatever endeavor that you're trying to achieve. But as I kept reading about, you know, critical language studies and critical identity studies and critical literacy, it took me further out and made me understand how broad language is and how deep it is in your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, so when I say how education saved my life, I'm not just talking about, you know, struggling through freshman English at Cleveland State University and having the professors to dog my writing out and dog out my black dialect or dog out my not knowing how to do mechanics, you know, my essays. I'm talking about how I had to learn who I was and that I was worth something. Mm-hmm. I was worth something. I can't throw my culture away. I can't throw my identity away. I didn't realize that, you know, like my mother and my grandmother and the poor people, and you know, that prayed for me, my family members, my background, I was made to think that was something, you know, ignorant, stupid, and dumb. You know, like you come from poor people, you come from Jamaica, you come from you know, the poor parts of Jamaica. This is your background, and your dad came from the poor parts of Newport News, Virginia, and these you came from a slave ancestry. And so I was, you know, that was all of that was a part of, excuse me, but being a nigger,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, but when I really started learning about who I was and what that meant and to value, like, all those other systems of knowing, all those ways that people were able to survive even when they were supposed to be wiped out and even when they were devalued, it gave me, you know, a sense of, wait a minute, now I'm a lot more than I've ever been made to think I was. And it's so important to your whole existence to know really who you are. And I had heard that before, you know, that people need to know who they are. But when I start really getting deeper and deeper into critical language and literacy studies, it made the difference to me. And that's why I wrote the book, because there's so many people out here in pain, different kinds of pain, because they have been made to feel like they'll never be anything. And nothing that you have is worth anything. And for whatever your situation was, you know, it might not have been that you got raped. It might not have been that you became a prostitute. It might not have been that you were sexually exploited and domestically abused or whatever. It might be something totally different. But all of that is you know, life, and is divine. Life mm-hmm. is to be. It's something to marvel. And I just feel like we, especially as Black people and especially poor Black people, have been made to think that we don't have anything of value. And it's just so, it's such a lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a lie. And it's so important to think about and to use who you are
mm-hmm.
and to understand who you are and that you're never finished. You know, you never finish, that you're always growing and that you are so much more than you think you are. So I think sexuality and race and gender and, you know, cultural identity, all of that is wrapped up in education. And education is so much more than we have been made to think that it is.
Right, exactly. And I want to point out that what comes shiningly through your book is not just the formal or traditional education of school,
mm-hmm.
but one of the things that makes your story a story of triumph is connected to your culture. It's the fact that your shame tree was not diminished. You still have the shame tree. How is it said in Jamaican?
Shame tree. Shame.
Your shim tree, yeah. Your shim tree ain't dead yet. Yeah.
That's right.
And you.
That's right.
And the trope of the shim tree continues. And that's one of the things that you held on to in your struggle, is this saying from your grandmother and your mother about having some dignity, even though you mm-hmm. Experienced some things that were very difficult. And I want to talk about those right now. Because in many ways, Elaine, your initiation into the street life is unusual. On one hand, it's quick, and on another hand, it takes some time. So, you know, you forgive the pointedness, but you got turned out very early, 13, 14?
Yes.
And you, at that time, you were not heavy into drinking or drugs. That developed later. But can you you just tease out for a moment for listeners who are reading your book or who will read the book at 13, 14, how it is that a 17-year-old or 18-year-old mm-hmm. boy can have this impact and effect on your life and sort of get you initiated into the street culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, the guy that raped me was 19. And I was really naive, and I was really under this kind of fairy tale thing, you know, like this guy had taken an interest in me. And but basically, he really just wanted the panties, basically. And so he took the panties, right, just the guy that raped me at 13.
And let me just interject for a second, because this is really this was important for me as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
Rape is when you say no and a person continues to force himself upon you, which is what happened in your situation.
Right.
Okay.
And it took me a long time to understand that it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was stupid enough to go into a bedroom with him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, want to be adored and want to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to, you know, go all the way. I didn't want to go any other way. I just wanted to be admired.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and
desired.
And the age difference, 19 and 13.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's very important because, you know, a lot, you know, girls at that age, you know, 11, 12, 13, you're looking for your identity. And you see all these different, there are all these different narratives out here about what it means to be beautiful, what it means to be, a pretty girl, what it means to be a cool girl, you know, and to be wanted. And I think that's normal for girls to want to be wanted, to want to be attractive, you know, to feel attractive. Everybody wants to feel attractive. That's the society. You know, you get that message from society about what, you know, what is beautiful. And I wanted him to make me feel beautiful. Mm-hmm. It made me feel beautiful that somebody was interested in me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you have low self-esteem and somebody is interested in you, you're not understanding the full ramifications of how you could be taken advantage of at 11, 12, and 13,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. How people are reading you,
mm-hmm.
right, as a poor black girl. Because to them, you know, you're a piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're some fresh meat waiting to be had, and that's how I was viewed by him.
Mm-hmm. So, let me ask you this, Elaine. Do you mm-hmm. think that the guy that you call Andrew, mm-hmm. who was, I think he was 17 at the time. Do you think that Andrew, when he first approached you, had in mind for you to become a street worker?
I think so. So let me get to that part. So your question was, how did I get turned out by him?
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you ask me that?
I did, yes.
And so I had been raped and I had gotten pregnant and I had an abortion at 13. Very low self-esteem. Grieving over the fact that I knew I killed somebody when I had this abortion. Not knowing how to deal with it, never went to any kind of treatment. You know, my mother just did the best she could by putting all her money together to try to help me get this abortion because my mother had that American dream in her mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she was, you know, had a hard life in Jamaica, and she wanted something different for myself and my brother. And so when I told my mother, you know, I didn't want this baby, I never even told my mother who I was pregnant by or how I got pregnant. I just told her I didn't want it, and I was desperate to have this abortion. And my mother got it for me. She had to take me to New York. Because by the time she found out, I was almost 6 months pregnant and nobody in the state of Ohio would do it. So, you know, I had this abortion and I'm now on birth control pills. And I meet this guy, Andrew, one of my next door neighbors, a girl I grew up with. She was going with this guy and he was her boyfriend's friend. And I meet him, and he is extra beautiful, good-looking, 17-year-old guy that has his own car and that is interested in me. So, you know, I'm like, oh, my God, this really good-looking guy is interested in me. And, you know, it just went from there. And the more I got to know him, you know, I was introduced to, little by little, what he did. And at the end of the day, he was a thief and a street dude. And at first he, after, you know, after a while, introduced me into the street life of what he did. He was what you call a tennis shoe pimp. That's a non-flashy pimp that wears sneakers, and that's a hustler, like a street hustling type of thug dude. And he broke into, you know, he worked on the stroll behind this woman, this older woman that he was his girl.
Fat bitch.
And she was a hooker. And her, you know, they called her fat bitch. And, but anyway, she, you know, she was a hooker. And, you know, first I started out kind of like being his right-hand man or his right-hand girl, his ride-or-die broad. And I just, you know, got introduced little by little until he got busted. And he needed money to pay off a lawyer for his case. And he had her to show me how, you know, to work. And that's how I got involved in street life. Because, you know, by that time, now I'm head over heels, madly in love with him, cutting school for, you know, every day or three or four times a week. You know, I'm not doing well in school. I'm in junior high school. And I've become a juvenile delinquent. And, you know, my mother tried to get help from me, big sisters. My mother tried to get me locked up in the juvenile home. She tried to do like a scared straight thing with me to have me locked up overnight in the juvenile home. You know, she tried the best she could as, you know, somebody who only went to the sixth grade and with limited resources and who had to work two jobs every day to try to, you know, save me. But, you know, I found ways to get around her saving me or her, you know, trying to keep me away from this life that I was getting into or that I was into.
Now, let me ask you this question at this point. At this point that when you become initiated into the street life as a prostitute and working also as a thief because you were jacking cars with Andrew as well. What was your shim tree saying to you at this moment? And maybe you want to define that
for... This was the life that I deserved. This was, you know, this was who I was. This was what I deserved. This was, you know, this guy likes me. Regular guys don't like me. This is the life for me. If it obviously this, you know, should be happening to me because it is happening to me, and this is who I'm going to be. This is who I am.
There were moments of resistance in the book. I mean, you were ultimately persuaded and overcome, but there were some moments of resistance. I mean, with certain early encounters with the woman that's called Fat Bitch or certain sexual experience that Andrew wanted you to do, you protested. The reason why I'm asking this question is because I think that there may be a number of girls or boys, for that matter, in your situation. You know, or and how is it that they can listen to their, I don't know what you call it, their inner self or the voice of resistance as opposed to acquiescing, even though it's a struggle? Like that's what I'm asking about. Ultimately, you do do something different, but at that moment, is there something that the people who might be in that situation can hang on to and struggle to climb out of a situation that might spiral them down too far down the wrong path?
Well, I think when you don't have the proper self-love the proper self, I hate to use the word self-esteem because it sounds so easy. But I think that when you don't have that you're open and susceptible to a lot of things that you would not be if you knew who you were or if you knew your worth. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I don't think that I knew my worth. I did not know my worth, and I just resigned myself at those times to, well, you know, this is my fate, and it'll get better somehow. I don't know how, but it'll get better.
And it did. And I want to move us forward just a little bit, just for the sake of time, because there's so much that we can talk about in this book. And I want to say for our listeners that this book is beautifully written. It's poignant. It's elegant. It's a mixture of Jamaican culture and African-American life, urban life, and dialect. I mean, I love the way that you bring in these sayings from your grandma and your mother and Tretton for White. And I was trying to hear these sort of things in my mind. I know I'm not saying it or pronouncing it in the Jamaican style.
You're good, though. You're close. Yeah.
It's really...
You're not Tretton for White.
Right, exactly. I love those moments. And the book has a cast of wonderfully complex characters. The sisters, Jane and Jean, Candy, Mac, and so many others. And I want to talk about some of these people because the way that you tell this story, you know, let me speak personally, was attracted to these characters, especially the two sisters, Jane and Jean, and Candy. These were, where Candy was a street worker, but of sort of higher class sort, elegant. Jane and Jean, they were hustlers. They were beautiful women. Had barriers. In other words, you know, they wouldn't do certain things. Although, you know, they would do others. But the thing that is interesting to me is the way you wrote this book, this wonderful narrative, is that you didn't. You didn't give too much away too soon. You took us on this journey and let us meet these characters, let us know who they were and basically how you saw them. For instance, Candy, and what she did for you taught you, you know, how to increase your elegance and your beauty and show you how to put on makeup and dress up and so forth. But then her life turned out drastically. It was a tragedy. I mean, she was beautiful, but then why don't you tell us about her and maybe another character? I don't want to give too much away, but maybe you could pick up the story about Candy.
Candy, when I first met Candy, she was with this guy who was her child's father, and you know, he was a pimp, and she, you know, she was a worker. She was a sex worker, and she was also underage. She actually tried her best not to have sex with guys that she went out with, because she was what you would call a sneak thief. She knew how to beat guys, you know, out their wallet. And, you know, like giving them some sex was like the last resort to get the wallet, you know. So she, you know, like that was her brand, like, you know, she was known as being one of the baddest sneak thieves in Cleveland. And, you know, she, taught me how to work with her. And she worked hotels and conventions and, parties, you know, those kinds of things, or she would work the streets if she had to. But for the most part, she tried not to be on the streets that often. But eventually, she did, you know, like her main guy got killed, and she got with this other guy, this other family. And they were all street people, you know, strictly street walkers. And, you know, so she was strictly, at that point, she was really, you know, like just a street girl. And she gained a lot of weight. You know, she had, you know, gained a lot of weight after her guy got killed. And she was just different, you know. After, you know, I had gone away and gone to Cleveland State and came back to the street life. And so she, you know, we had lost touch with each other because I had not been out there again. I had like this dual identity going where people didn't know that I was the same girl who was turning tricks with Andrew and Fat Bob. And but anyway, when I hooked back up with her, she was with like this whole big family. And she wound up eventually getting killed. For taking this police officer's wallet. He, you know, he came back and shot her in the head.
Wow.
By the time she was murdered, though, I was a student at Cleveland State. And I think I was in the master's program, if I'm not mistaken, when she got killed.
Now, what do you think is was the turning point or the difference between someone like you and someone like Candy? Because when I read about these characters, they all seem to have redeeming qualities. Even the worst person in the book.
Who is that?
Well, I who's the worst person? I think the worst person was the not Andrew, but your second pimp. To me, I think that AC was a dog to me. I mean, just plain up, straight out. And then Mac was no better, you know, because Mac was two-faced, you know, living a double life in the life. You know, I didn't like that. Talking about, you know, he didn't want no bitch that was on dope or whatever. And then he turned around freebasing and stuff. See, that kind of thing bothered me throughout the book. But even these people had redeeming qualities. And I think a lot of it was because of the way in which you saw them. And it's not naive, but you see the humanity in everybody, all these characters, and you illustrate their humanity. You don't beat them down and say, you know, they were on the streets and I'm a professor now and they're no good. That's not the approach that you take. And it's wonderful that you don't. It's about humanity. It's about life. It's about how circumstances can impact people. It's about those negative qualities that can be exploited in the wrong environment and so forth.
And you know what? The thing about, you know, I think a lot about Andrew and Mac is both of them say the same thing to me. Like, you know, we're just doing this shit now. But, you know, I'm going to send you to school because you're smart. You know, they said things like that to me that let me know that they saw something in me, too, that they might not have seen it in themselves. But I saw in them where they could have been something else too. You know what I mean? But they
didn't see
other ways that they could get out. You know, be who they wanted to be.
What happened to Andrew?
Andrew is still alive and is still struggling. Both of them are really still struggling with, you know, using. They're not in the street life anymore, of course, but they're struggling with, you know, drug use.
Because, I mean, you're not, you don't ostracize or stay away from Cleveland. I mean, you are still in some ways connected to Cleveland. What's the impact that your presence has on people from your past who are still struggling?
So many people just show me so much love. It's amazing. It's really amazing. You know, so many people have died too, you know, but before they died, they would say things to me, you know, like, oh man, I heard you were doing good. You look so good. And, you know, even when my kids were little, you know, and I would be in Cleveland and we would ride by somewhere and see somebody I knew, and I would pull over and talk to them. You know, they would hug me and my kids and, you know, just wish me well and want to see me keep going. And, you know, and I would try to talk to them about, you know, when they're going to you know, clean up or whatever. And you know, it was like, you know, I'm trying to get it together, or I'm doing good now, or you know what I mean. But people were always rooting for me.
Very nice.
People were always rooting for me. And we were always rooting for each other. You know, I was rooting for them too. But some people just haven't. I think a lot of people don't forgive themselves for things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think forgiving yourself for. I wrote a song recently called Life Wasted. And it's really like a lamentation to you not understanding how valuable you are when you're younger, you know, or, you know, parts of your life that you could have spent doing something else,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't know how, you know. So I don't hate anybody, and I feel like we were all just kind of lost, that people are lost in certain ways,
mm-hmm.
and they can't find their way back to that beautiful part of themselves that, you know, before whatever it is that made you start doing things that chip away at your spirit or your shin tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get back, you know, like it's like you got to rebuild that again. You got to rebuild that again. And I think that people don't forgive themselves to be able to do it sometimes.
Elaine, will you read a passage from the book for us?
Sure. Since you were asking me so much about the getting turned out part, I figured that I would read some of that part. So this is from... This is from chapter 4, and this chapter is called Tricked Out. And it deals with my introduction to the street life at the age of 13 by a grown woman who was my first boyfriend's other girlfriend, who was an older woman. And so this is from that part. I certainly watched Andrew's back. When he shot dice, I watched his back. When he did breaking and enterings, I watched his back. When he stole cars, I watched his back. By now, I was well seasoned in various aspects of the street life. One night, Andrew went out to hit a lick. He said I shouldn't come alone this time, that he was going to do it with his friend Ricky. He bought me a pizza, a Pepsi, and a pack of cigarettes, and told me to wait at his house until he came back. I waited and waited and waited. Hours and hours went by. I didn't go home. I was too worried about him. I stayed there until I awoke in the morning to Lil T banging on the bedroom door. Sis, wake up. Andrew on the phone. I jumped up and ran downstairs to the phone. Hi, babies. When you coming home? I got busted. I need some grants for a lawyer and my bail. I called Fat Bitch already. I don't want you out doing no car tamperings or shooting no dice or nothing while I'm in here. I need you to work with Fat Bitch. She'll teach you everything you need to know about the stroll. Here? She gonna keep all the money y'all make every night until y'all got enough to get me out of here. You love me, don't you? You know I do. Well, go with her every night and then go straight home. If you make money early, you can go home early. Go to school and try to stay in good with your mama. You're my school girl anyway. I want you to finish. I'm going to send you to college. We're just doing this shit till I get on my feet. That night at dusk, Fat Bitch met me over Andrews. She pulled up in front of the house with some old man, one of her regular tricks, I guess. I had on a skirt, but I wasn't dressed like a street girl. I had on a little makeup, not much. You think you're going to make money dressed like that? She said when I walked out to get in the car. I just jumped in the back seat of the car because I already knew she ain't like me. The feeling was mutual. We went on Crawford Road between Chester and Huff. the dude, she had to drive us over there, stayed parked out across from the so-called hotel all night. The hotel was actually somebody's rooming house. That bitch explained what she wanted me to do, what she wanted me to know about turning a trick. This hotel cost $2. The object of the game is to get a trick to go in the hotel with you. Never tell them how much it costs. Start off by letting them tell you how much they can spend. The first law of hoeing is get your money first. Hide it under your wig. Well, you ain't got no wig. Just put it in your shoe. And don't take your shoes off. When you get them in the room, try to make them come fast as you can. Time is money. Make them wash off their dick before you let them stick it anywhere. Always look at it real good and squeeze it. If you see something coming out of their dick, they got a disease. Never let a motherfucker lay on top of you. A trick shouldn't take no longer than 5 minutes. You know how to use a rubber? I thought you was a dumb bitch. Keep a fresh rubber in your mouth at all times. If a motherfucker wants you to suck their dick, work the rubber over their dick without them knowing you got it in your mouth. Some of these nasty motherfuckers don't want to wear no rubber. If a motherfucker wants some pussy, that costs extra. And you got to make them wear rubber. You got any? No. Here, pay me back after you break luck. The man in the hotel sells them for $1 a wop. Buy your own. Get busy. I kind of knew how to walk. I saw girls walking all the time on Euclid. Plus, I saw girls on 95th and Cedar Avenue all the time, ever since I was little. Since me and Mama used to ride buses past there when she used to take me to day's work with her sometimes. I sashayed up and down the street, looking in the cars, waving if I saw a man inside. It wasn't long before somebody pulled over to me. As soon as they did, she come running her fat ass over there. Hey, baby, you want to have a good time? Come on with me. I had no idea we were in competition. She wanted to make more money than me. The trick said, I want to talk to your friend. How much you charging, baby? How much can you spend? I asked. The hotel is $2. I got 40 for some pussy. Okay. Pull up into the parking lot of the hotel. As the young, good-looking black guy was pulling up into the parking lot and I walked past that bitch, she chuckled, saying, one thing I forgot to mention. Never sell no pussy to a young nigga. He ain't gonna want to get up in 5 minutes. And never get in the car with a young nigga. Most of them will rob you and rape you. Thanks, I said. Want me to keep going?
That's beautiful. That's great. I mean, that's...
You say that's beautiful.
I know. It's ironic to say that. I mean, the writing style is wonderful. It's gripping. It comes across. We get the scene, the narrative, the conflict, the struggle, everything. Really comes across. So, Elaine, I want to start winding down here, and I want you to have a moment to say whatever it is you want to say to readers about what you want us to get from your book.
That every life, I think, has value. We never know. You know, I've been struggling with this, and it's a human problem. You know, some people have killed people and done heinous things, and for some reason, their life can teach us something. Maybe they can be, you know, they can come back and not do whatever the heinous thing is that they've done. But I think that even if they can't, their life is worth something and it has a purpose. And I think that a lot of people have been thrown away. And I don't want to contribute to throwing anybody away. I think we should strive to save lives because so many people are thrown away. And I think my life is an example of a life that was thrown away. But a lot of people, especially my mom and different mentors that came into my life, different people helped to not let me kill myself. And I think I'm turning out to be worth something, you know. And I think that other people, everybody deserves a chance to however many chances they need. And I think education is so much bigger than, you know, we've been traditionally taught to think about it.
We appreciate you, Dr. Elaine Richardson. Thank you for joining us on New Books in African American Studies.
I hope you have enjoyed this installment of New Books in African American Studies, talking to Elaine Richardson, professor of education at The Ohio State University, about her new autobiography, PhD to PhD, How Education Saved My Life. Elaine Richardson is also a performance artist, and she's available for book talks at your school, organization, or agency, as well as for a performance of her one-woman show based on this provocative memoir.